You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, the only Land Rover podcast on the planet. This is show number 40 for July 2016. This is a podcast by, for, and about Land Rover owners. I encourage you to visit our website, centersteer.com, which is C-E-N-T-R-E, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to stories discussed in today's show. We're also part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and I invite you to check out the other 4x4-related shows at 4x4radionetwork.com. And also, big thanks to everybody for your comments, follows, likes on Facebook, Twitter, and email. We had a nice upsurge in folks from Colorado because we've been talking with the Sully Hall Society this week to get them on as guests. And so those folks, welcome to them for joining us and listening to the show. I'm your host, John Costage, and joining me from the wonderful part of Pennsylvania, which we know as near Pittsburgh, Western Pennsylvania, is my contributor sitting across from me.
I'm Harold.
And our contributor from the Green Mountain State.
Hi, I'm Morgan.
And Morgan is going to have us a heritage segment today. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Wonderful. But before we do all that, the weather today, because I like talking about the weather in Western Pennsylvania, it's hot. It's 90 degrees with like 95% humidity. It's nasty. So it's unlike all the other times when we typically come to talk to you and the weather's really nice and pleasant. Today is not a pleasant weather day.
Well, then I wish you get the nice storms we had last night that cooled us down. So
usually when that happens, the humidity increases and it makes it even worse for about, an hour after the storm comes
through. If it happens in the evening, it's not too bad. But when it happens like was that yesterday or the day before, we had it in the late morning, we had a storm. And then sun came out and hit the glistening grass. And yeah, it was just...
Oh, yeah, that makes it miserable.
Yep. Well, I was not home yesterday. I was about 15 miles south. And
Helltown.
I was actually in Helltown.
I'm in hell.
I came back home. And my neighbor said, "Did you get rain?" Nope. Apparently, here over the house, it rained for a good 15 minutes. He said it was a gully washer,
down for a good bit, but then it resumed being not fun after that.
Yeah, it didn't hit Mount Pleasant. It just was just here in North Huntington. So. All right, let's kick off the show. We have for you some guests coming up. We're going to have two guests today on the show. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about the news. And first up, there's a new Disco 5, and it has been spotted, and it is caught unmasked, even though it's in its kind of camo livery. The one we're looking at here from Autoblog is in a black and white, and there's also a red and black. I kind of like the red and black.
Got to say, the red and black is nice.
I wonder how much they charge for that. You think that'd be a special paint job they would offer?
I suspect you might be able to request it through SVO.
That's true.
And considering every pattern seems to be unique, it's probably fairly pricey.
Ooh. Oh, you could get your own bespoke pattern. That would be cool. Because this one's angular. I know Harold doesn't like some of the swirly ones, but...
Well, I'm not a fan of Paisley, but I do like the fact that every time you see a picture of one of these things in development camo, it's different.
Yeah, it's true.
The question is, do they have that many different development mules out there, or do they just rewrap them every time with something new?
I don't know. But this one, the Disco 5, Discovery 5, looks like all the newer Land Rover line. There is a little nod to the Alpine window bump in the back. You really got to look for it. But it does
bring a magnifying glass and a straight edge.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree on that either. It's very hard to tell.
Well,
if you have to look that hard, it's not there.
The picture we're looking at, though, has the roof rack connectors on it. And if you take that off, there's a video that we looked at earlier that when you could see the bump was more pronounced when you don't have the roof rack on it. So,
And they also sort of kept the back window more vertical than the other models, but
yeah.
Again, still, we're kind of reaching here.
It does not look like any Disco you've seen in the past. It is not boxy. It is...
And just on the very conceptual level, once you have to start using the word sorta, you're no longer talking about a Land Rover, in my opinion.
Well, I think you're talking, this is a modern Land Rover.
Yeah,
I think
but that's the problem, that the design has devolved into to sort of this and sort of that. It was never in the vernacular of Land Rover.
So the new Disco is supposed to come out in 2017. It's going to supposed to have a supercharged 3-liter V6 and a diesel V6. And there are rumors that the current supercharged V6 might be replaced by a turbocharged inline six from Ford, and a plug-in hybrid may also become an option sometime down the line. So that is the new Disco on the way. There's a link in the show notes to it being driven on a test track. And it's about a 2-minute video of it driving around at kind of higher speed. So if you want more, check that out. Next, the 2017 Range Rover Sport Coupe, or Coupe, as we would say here, could go electric. So we talked about this last month. There's going to be a new Range Rover model, the Evoque XL, if you will. It's slotted between the Evoque and the Range Rover Sport, and it's going to be based off of the Jaguar F-Pace. And this apparently is going to be called the Sport Coupe, or at least we think that's the name. Although they did say, the JLR has said that the Range Rover Sport name will stay with the current Range Rover Sport.
Interesting. And it sounds like it'll be mostly diesel or hybrid drivetrains, but possibly could have the all-electric powertrain that they're developing for the I-Pace EV. So that could be interesting.
Yeah. And it's going to be a Luxro high-end model. Probably be a little pricey.
But maybe marketed towards younger, well-heeled techno geeks.
Yeah, they're calling them kind of the urban cool buyers.
Mm-hmm. It's the folks that buy the BMW X6 and that one Mercedes, I don't recall, but So hey, there's a market to fill there, because otherwise they wouldn't be going after it.
Right.
And they're going to do that. So that's that. So that's
I think the more traditional Range Rover people that are already into the Range Rover brand are the people who want the bigger ones. So this sort of expands their reach.
Right. Right. And it fits the family model they're going into, the Range Rover family, the Defender family, the Disco family. So, and you can buy the baby Range Rover, the Evoque, and then as you get older, make more money, you can move up, and then you have the fun ones. So, Land Rover put out a Instagram photo of their new SVO facility, and it looks very airy and open and glass and space agey. So there is a picture of that. We'll have a link to that in the show notes if you want to see what it looks like. It's maybe the closest I'll ever get to the SVO facility. Also, they're supposed to expand the SVO brand, and which would mean more faster models coming out. I think we'd mentioned that last time, but there's another article talking about how that tech center is going to increase different offerings.
Yeah, it sounds like between the Range Rover Sport SVRs and the Jaguar F-Pace SVRs, they might even be able to do it new models as frequently as every year through 2020 using this new facility, because it's so much bigger.
Well, there we go. How much of those come to the U.S.? Are they all U.S., or is that basically European or rest of world? Do we know?
I'm not entirely sure. I know that they're definitely available in Europe, so I don't think it's...
And there are SVO versions that come to the U.S., I believe.
Yeah.
But I just wonder if they all do, or if it's, they slotted for different countries, or... You know.
No, they're definitely available throughout Europe.
Speaking of Europe, we all know there was a vote in the U.K. called Brexit, and the only reason we'll touch on it here is just because there is an implication for Jaguar Land Rover, and there is an estimate that they may have a decline of £1 billion within a decade if the UK does in fact leave the European Union, as this would result in increased tariffs for the in and out of the UK, and so it would increase the JLR's costs. It would potentially pass those costs on to the consumers, or just reduce how much investment money they have to put into other models and things. So it could help in the short term. It might help us here in the US to get heritage parts out of the UK because of a potential temporary reduction in the exchange rate, I guess, in our favor, right? In the U.S.'s favor.
And certainly the pound has dropped significantly anyway, just because of fear.
Right. Well, that, yes, that would give us better purchasing power here in the U.S. to buy things from England. But if they cost more to bring into England because the stuff's not made there, then it's a short-term improvement for us. But eventually their costs will go up, which will bring our costs up too.
Yep. Right. And there's discussion, apparently, that they might put a hold or a pause on that Slovakia plant that they're considering. And
well, sure, it would cost them more to put in.
Correct.
It would behoove them to build another plant in the UK if they're going to leave Europe.
Well, interesting, they also mentioned they might put a hold on the Silverstone purchase, too. Maybe part of that. Maybe they're just waiting to see how things settle out, would be kind of my take. But it's important to note that... For JLR, the European market is a quarter of their vehicles. You know, they sell they sold 520,000 vehicles last year, and a quarter of those went to the European market. So that's not, you know, this is not insignificant, I guess, effect on this specific automaker.
I think it's a not insignificant effect on a lot of companies and people in the UK. So
right,
we'll have to see how it plays out.
Indeed. In the technological space, Land Rover has started real-world tests of innovative, connected, and autonomous vehicle technology. And this is a PR list from Land Rover. So they're getting into, as many other companies are, you know, testing autonomous vehicles. They created to create a fleet of more than 100 research vehicles over the next 4 years to develop a wide range of connected autonomous vehicle technologies. The first of these research cars will be driven on a new 41-mile test route on motorways and urban roads around Coventry and Solihull throughout 2016.
Yeah, it sounds like they're mostly focusing on vehicle-to-vehicle and vehicle-to-infrastructure communications, as well as like sensors to see what the environment is and, you know, other vehicles. So they've got some interesting stuff they're working on. Some of the ones they highlighted are safe pull away. So it's got some cameras so that, like, as you're driving away from a parked situation, it'll detect if there's, like, people or pets or objects in front of you.
Another car.
A car, exactly. Some over-the-horizon warnings so vehicles can talk to each other and know that if they encounter something over a hill, that'll sense and warn other vehicles on the other side of the hill.
See, what they need to do, Morgan, is have a retrofit kit to put on to older Heritage Land Rovers, because they're the ones that are going to be the bottleneck and the breakdown, and they need to ping when they're stopped. So that,
exactly, you know, and that's actually one of the ones that they have is a stopped vehicle hazard warning that just lets other vehicles know. So yeah,
that
anybody with
that
serious
difficult
vehicle not having brakes and being most likely to break down, they should have this.
Well, a simple transponder that could send a ping out from a series vehicle would be pretty simple retrofit. You wouldn't have to have all the info to the driver, because the driver doesn't really need any more input than he's already getting in a series truck.
Right. You already sort of assume that it's not going to stop when you need it to.
You know it's not going to stop. You know it's not going to accelerate. And you got your hands full just keeping it on the road. So last thing you need is another electronic distraction. But if you could have a transponder on board that would send out a warning to other vehicles that you are in the neighborhood.
And in all seriousness, I could see that happening within 5 or 10 years, where that might be required on older vehicles that do not have any autonomous technology or connected technology, just so that you know they're out there. You know, because if you do break down over a hill, especially in our part of the state, you know, a lot of hills here. And,
as a compromise to allow us to not only operate, but to import vintage vehicles, that might be an okay compromise.
There we go.
Yeah. Just sort of plug it in and let it do its thing, a little GPS and transponder, and that's all you have to do.
Yeah. Land Rover is also working on autonomous off-road vehicle technology, which I know immediately, you know, us as enthusiasts, especially off-roading enthusiasts, you know, don't like the idea.
It seems pointless. The whole point of going out and off-road is to experience the driving experience and to enjoy the outdoors. And just seems to me that if you want the vehicle to do the driving for you, why not just stay home and watch a show on the Outdoor Channel?
Valid points. There's in the show notes, we'll have a Wired magazine took a test drive of this autonomous vehicle. And they have a video out there, so it's interesting to watch. It's 2 minutes. course, it's important to note that the driver still needs to hold onto the wheel and point the vehicle in the right direction, but then everything else is kind of automated where it decides the speed, the approach angles and which track to take. It's looking ahead for water and rocks and changing in terrain, which is actually all interesting technology. The only thing that I can see that would be a benefit or a positive to this approach and this technology would be actually using this use of this off-road technology would be for on-road, and that's in bad weather. Because the thing I've been, when I read about autonomous vehicles and I read about those kinds of technologies, they never mention bad weather, snow, ice, rain, flooding, any of that. And I can see this kind of being used in a positive way for on-roading when you're on the road, knowing that, oh, there's a flood up. You can make it through, or you can't. Or there's snow. All of a sudden, there's snow on the ground. Or maybe it detects ice when you don't even, human can't at night. Those could be benefits there. That's the only good thing I can see come out of this. But other than that, yeah.
If they could figure out a way to make that work properly.
Which I'm sure they will. I mean, that's technology, usually makes pace that way. And but the interesting things, the technologies they're looking at is the surface ID, which is scanning the surface ahead to seeing what goes on there. Apparently, we could instantaneously soften the air suspension at the exact moment a vehicle encounters a speed bump, which apparently Mercedes already has, called Magic Body Control. I never had not heard of that before. There's terrain-based speed adaptation, off-road connected convoy, which actually we kind of do already now, and it's called a CB, which is...
I thought it was called a toe strap.
Or a toe strap. So those kinds of things. Yeah, I'm sure none of us that listen to the show, I don't think there's anything we would be interested in or want. I think I read in one of the articles is, can it be turned off? It's all nice and all well and good, but at the end of the day, can we turn it off? Because part of what you want to do when you're out off-roading is challenging yourself and trying to see if you can overcome the obstacle and have you figured it out. And it defeats the purpose, as you said, if a computer's going to do it for you. I can see it as an aid, but definitely not taking over.
And the problem with the aid is that I think it discourages people from learning how to do this stuff on their own. And they get lured into this false sense of security. They assume, well, I've got all these gadgets that'll keep me from being stupid, so I don't need to do anything. And then I don't think that's good for anybody.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where, we already have these vehicles that can take us very far and get us stuck in the middle of nowhere. If you can get even further because it just sort of does everything for you and then you're stuck, you're going to have no idea what to do.
Yeah, especially when the system breaks, which it can happen.
Right.
And it will happen. Mistakes will be made. Mistakes are already made by human drivers. So, computers will continue to also make mistakes.
Yeah.
Usually less so, but yeah.
But then again, like you said, in inclement weather, some of this stuff, like all their ultrasonic and radar and LiDAR and stereo cameras and stuff, like, most cars these days, I guess they're getting better, but most of them, in terms of like snow or ice, will only have like a little light that lights up on the dash saying it's around freezing temperature. How many drivers actually pay attention to that, except those of us who know how to drive in ice and snow?
Yeah. Well, my Jetta pops up when it gets down to 39 degrees, and there's just a reminder that it's potentially an ice potential situation. It's good to be reminded. It's annoying.
Well, it's good, and especially if you're on a long trip and you start out where it's warm, and then you dip into an area where it's locally quite cold and could be icy, and you're not thinking about it because where you left, it was warm.
Right. Yeah.
Right. But, that's for those of us who drive in snow and understand that we have to be careful. Having some of these things for the people who just have no idea, it might make things safer in the long run, but it's still, even being an IT guy, a computer guy, it's a lot of technology to rely on.
Yeah, but that's the way of the world. It's happening.
Absolutely.
I'll make the... kind of an opposite argument, I guess, for the benefit of some of this stuff too. There are those of us who do enjoy driving and generally know how to drive in different varying conditions and know what to do. But the vast majority of people do not, as you just said. So by them not driving because the car has taken over, that reduces their potential to be a hazard on the road and increases my enjoyment potentially. At least that's a one way I can see that happening, where you kind of eliminate some of the bad drivers out there or people who are not paying attention.
Well, the easier way to do that is to up the requirements for people who want to get a driver's license. Teach them to drive or else they're not allowed to drive. That accomplishes the same thing.
Well, that's it does.
It gets bad drivers off the road one way or another.
Yeah, but it doesn't sell cars. And that's, and car companies aren't going to allow that to happen. They still want to sell. At the end of the day, they got to sell. They got to push product.
Well, I know it's a big car in action.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Moving on, big news in all over the social medias. I think it was this past week, or maybe it was the week before. But the Land Rover Defender comeback rumors not true, says firm. So there was a rumor out there that a chemical billionaire, Jim Ratcliffe, was going to resurrect the Defender and wanted to build it himself or buy the parts or do something. That was going on for a couple days. A lot of articles went around about that. But apparently, Mr. Ratcliffe said, I don't want to talk about it. And JLR came out and said, not going to happen. We own it. Not going to happen.
Yep. He actually kind of went back and forth a couple times. But yeah, that's the long and short of it. Yeah, Land Rover would never, ever give up that name.
Yeah, as we all know, they're trying to make a new Defender. So they were like, nope, we have plans for that.
Yep. Right. So that was out there. That was made everything all the Twitter.
And I think one of the interesting corollaries to that is just a little thing I saw in the social media where somebody was talking about, now that the UK is not going to be part of the European Union, the Defender no longer has to meet all those European requirements. Can we make it again?
No, because there are still other requirements in other parts of the world.
Well, yeah, Europe is still their biggest customer, as is the US, and we each have requirements, but the bottom line is they're too expensive to build. But I just thought it was humorous that someone would bring that up.
Yes. Actually, their biggest customers now is Asia. The U.S. and Europe are no longer in the lead.
We're still significant, though.
We're significant, but not number one.
And we have the most stringent requirements, so if you're not going to meet those, you're going to lose a big customer base.
Indeed, and hence the reason why they're changing the Defender in the first place. There's a whole market there.
And they can't afford to build them the same way anymore.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Yeah, there was being hand-built. Speaking of Defenders, the Heritage models, there were some seized, similar to the U.S., in South Africa. The article... there's not a lot of info here, and it's, of course, we'll have a link you can read yourself, but so we had some seized in the Western Cape police seized, a dozen models, maybe. I don't even know what the number was now that I can't remember how many
there
were.
It was just four.
It's three, and these are the Heritage Edition ones, so this is towards the ones that were done in the last run-up of the Defender line, and they were seized. The best I can figure, and there's a link to another article from this one, the best I can figure is they were counterfeit in some way, and that's my inference.
Yeah, I'm thinking they might be stolen, because there was, at the beginning of the article, they talk about the increased... wave of thefts of Defenders since the production stopped, which is actually what I thought was more interesting about the article than the actual seizure, is that the Defender has always been a high theft vehicle in the UK, but now that they're no longer being made, I guess there's the supply and demand has made them more profitable to steal.
Well, and also there's the actual Defender name now is at its 25-year limit for importing to the U.S.
Right.
And so I think that's been also helping spiking in that theft, because then you can take a properly old Defender, rebadge it a little bit, make it look like a newer one, but it's really an older one, and hopefully it gets through customs.
Which is harder to do than it used to be, mind you.
Exactly. Yes. Well,
for reasons such as this.
Right. Right. All right. Moving on. There's a new magazine out called Alloy and Grit. It's available only online and will soon, I think in November, they've announced that they're going to have a print edition. It's a Land Rover magazine. It's a Land Rover magazine, but its sub-headline here is North America's Independent Land Rover Journal. And they had an interesting article about Overfinch. And Overfinch is going to set up shop in North America because they apparently are doing so much business here in the U.S. They want to stop sending people and supplies over to do custom one-off stuff. So they're going to set up a shop in Virginia.
That makes sense. I mean, if you're repeatedly having to send people, it makes more sense just to base them here and cut your cost.
Yep. So they're doing a lot of business in South Florida, South Carolina, South California,
where the money is.
Where the money is, and but they're going to be So, Overfinch is. So if you want some Overfinch stuff, they're going to have their own shop here in the U.S. for the first time.
Yeah, they do high ticket builds, so makes sense.
Did they do the whiskey?
That was Holland and Holland.
Holland and Holland. I always get those two.
Whiskey and shotguns, always a good combination.
I should also note that Alloy and Grit will be guests on the future show. We have them, I think, maybe October. I think they're lined up for, but we're talking to them, getting them on the show. So if we'll get more about the Alloy and Grit folks very soon on the show. Check it out, though, at alloyandgrit.com. All right. Finally, in Land Rover news, we turn to Heritage. And the Land Rover Reborn Tour is up and running. For £29, you can tour the Land Rover production facilities that Land Rovers dating back to the 1940s continue to be driven and enjoyed both on and off-road, supported by introduction of Land Rover's Classic Workshop. And you can also utilize those workshop facilities and have your own Series 1 reborn by the manufacturer.
You can't personally utilize the facility. They won't let you work on your own truck there. But you could pay them to do it for you.
Right. Wouldn't that be nice?
I believe, thanks for the clarity. I believe you're right, yes. Actually, that would be an interesting idea. Let them, you could use their facilities and tools and parts, and you just basically do the labor yourself. That'd be interesting.
Now, I wouldn't mind just, even just working on somebody else's truck if they, give me, $29 off my admission if I turn the wrench for a few minutes.
Right, there you go. Yeah, right.
That'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So, okay, so how much to ship to the UK one way, work on it, ship it back, and then you're worried about £29 for the tour now.
Well, I'm not talking about sending my own truck, dude. I'm saying just...
Oh, get one there.
Just I'm just saying if I'm going to go for the tour, wonder if they'll give me a discount on the tour, if I help them out for an hour or two.
Okay. Oh, you want to be employee for an hour.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay. Yeah. That'd be cool. So if any of our listeners have a Series 1 and want it rebuilt to manufacturing standards by the actual manufacturer, check out Land Rover Reborn. And if you go on the tour, let us know. It's a 90-minute tour. Oh, you do get refreshments and welcome, so they welcome you. If you don't pay the money, they don't welcome you. Dedicated group tour guide and access to privileged areas. Maybe you will get to see the tools.
All right. Because I've never seen what tools look like.
These are Land Rover tools.
Yeah.
In the Land Rover shop.
Uh-huh.
They probably actually touched a Land Rover.
And I get to see what they look like. Yeah, I have no tools that have ever touched a Land Rover.
No. Not in the factory.
No, that would be true.
So that's the news for July 2016. We will be back after this short break with our guests from the Sully Hall Society. Welcome back to the Center Steer Podcast, show number 40. This is July 2016, and we now have joining us guest Jim Janessa, all the way from Colorado.
Colorado Springs, yeah.
Wonderful. Jim is with the Sully Hall Society, and he is the coordinator of the Land Rover National Rally. Jim, I'm excited to have you on the show. I want to thank you very much for joining us today. I believe this is your first ever Skype call.
Now, I've Skyped with the grandkids, but this is the first ever Skype podcast.
There we go. All right. And even though this is an audio podcast, Jim and I are looking at each other because we have the video on. So Jim is wearing his Sully Hall Society hat. Very nice, Jim. Well done. Oh, and he's wearing a Land Rover Colorado Springs shirt. Nice. You rovered up for us. Appreciate it. So, Jim, tell us about the National Rally, which, of course, I should say we have, listeners all around the world. And when we say we really mean the U.S., what's the National Rally about? How did it come to be?
Well, the Land Rover National Rally is probably, I think, in about its 25 or 26th year. It has been sponsored and conducted by the Sully Hall Society. Which was I think, two different clubs that combined about 20, 25 years ago. I've been a member of the Sully Hall Society since 2010 and actually going to the rallies. So the Land Rover National Rally that we put on each year alternates in even years like this year in Moab, Utah, and in odd years, somewhere in Colorado. So we can talk about a couple of places it's been recently, like Ouray in Colorado, Grand Junction, Breckenridge, and Leadville. And some of the future places that we're considering for future rallies, such as Crested Butte or Buena Vista, going back to a place we've been to before, like Leadville or even Glenwood Springs. So we've got a couple of places that we're considering. This year, though, we've got the Land Rover National Rally will be in the third week of September. So it'll be Monday through Friday, September 19th to 23rd. We used to do a Tuesday to Saturday schedule, but a lot of folks that are driving from Canada, the East Coast, one guy shipped his vehicle from Australia one year.
Then Whoa, we had to change the
dates because there was a movie being filmed in Moab that year. So he unfortunately his Rover came and so he enjoyed Moab at a different time. Mm-hmm. But so we've shifted to a Monday to Friday. So we register on Monday. We run trails on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday. And we have a cocktail party on Tuesday evening and a banquet on Friday evening. Thursday of the Land Rover National Rally is actually we do a volunteer event in the morning, helping clean up trails. We've built hiking trails, cleaned up some BLM land, and then in that afternoon we have a vendor barbecue and display. So our sponsors and our vendors put all their stuff out on display. We feed all the participants. That's open to the public. And then on Friday night is our big banquet. We raffle off some big stuff. We have awards for worst breakage. Unfortunately, I've won that a couple of times. Best servicing toe out, you know, how far did somebody have to get towed off the routes. But that also allows the weekend before and the weekend after for those folks who have a long way to drive.
Makes it easier for travel. Yeah.
Our keynote speaker this year for Friday's banquet is Mr. Ray Hyland. And, you know, you'd love to have a Land Rover guy with the name Hyland. And he and his family drove across Africa in his Series 1. And so he's going to bring it on out, and we'll roll it into our banquet hall through the big roll-up door and park it in there. And he'll talk to us about his experiences trekking across Africa.
What's the gentleman's name?
His name is Ray Hyland, Hyland. And I'm sorry. He's going to bring his D110 to display.
Oh, very
nice. And I think he is with, he may be with Adventure Trailer. So that would be another connection for him.
Right. You know, Highlander was actually the original name for the Freelander, except that Toyota had already registered it.
Toyota already had it. And that was my first Land Rover was a Freelander.
Good for you, man. Mine too. Oh, look at that. A Freelander guy. Look at that. Wonderful. I had a 2001 Alveston Red Freelander. I loved that truck. It was wonderful.
Yeah. We had my wife had been rear-ended in the snow out here in Colorado Springs and said, that's it, we're going four-wheel drive. And so we checked out a whole bunch of the little cute utes and settled on the Land Rover Freelander, mainly because it was the only one that the dealer would actually let us go out on the test track in snowy weather and try it out. Everybody else said, "Are you kidding? It's snowy and muddy." So we said, "You know, I think that settles it for us."
we'll come back to your personal Land Rover information, but let's get back to the National Rally. So you're gonna it's gonna take place.
In Moab, Utah,
which, by the way, is fantastic country. I was there back in the mid-90s. It is amazing, and I need to get to the rally, of course, and I hope to come when you're in Moab. But do you alternate between the two states? Because
we alternate between Moab, Utah, specifically, yeah. And then someplace in Colorado. Right. So we've moved around in Colorado quite a bit.
Is that because the clubs combine?
There's plenty of opportunities in both. Right. But in Moab or in Colorado, wherever we are, we offer a wide range of trails, from easy to medium to hard to really hard. And so any folks that are interested in coming out, I'd encourage you, even if you're a beginner off-roader, that we offer plenty of opportunities for scenic rides that are very gentle on the vehicle, stock vehicles, all the way up to some of the fully modified Land Rover buggies.
Sure. Now, is the switching between states because the two clubs combined?
No, it switches mainly because the popularity of Moab is that we want to make sure that we hold the rally frequently in Moab. And then in Colorado, there's just such a great variation in the many different locations that we shift around to different places.
Given your proximity to Moab, I think you'd be foolish not to showcase that in your event.
Absolutely. And, it's Land Rover National Rally. So, folks are coming from all over the place, and there's that expectation that they're going to get that range of challenge that Moab offers. Plus, as John's mentioned, the spectacular scenery. Arches National Park is right next to Moab. In fact, it's as famous for arches as it is for hiking, mountain biking, and four wheeling.
Oh, yeah. It really is national class off roading there, and maybe even world class.
When you go to Moab, do you get to go? What trails do you get to go on? Is it public land? Is it the Native American land? What's the situation there? I'm mainly asking for me because I'm curious.
It is. So it's Bureau of Land Management is probably 90% of what we go four wheeling on. There's also some SITLA, which is the Native American lands. And we normally coordinate that through the BLM office in Moab, and then we also go four wheeling on some trails on private land. So there's a few guys that got together. It's called Area BFE. It's just a few miles south of the city of Moab, and on a big tract of land, they've got everything again from easy to medium to extraordinarily difficult. And they also have a little hillside next to the parking lot where you can watch the guys go up these dastardly trails. In fact, I think I've got the name of, let's see, they have one called Hell Dorado.
Now, do I understand correctly that BFE is a privately held land?
That's correct. There were a few guys that went in together, purchased this track to preserve access. It's free to use. There's a little donation box at the beginning, and we like to run trails each time we come out with the Land Rover National Rally to help promote preserving access to various trails and to show that that off-roaders are responsible and can take care of the trails, stay on the trails and preserve those trails for everybody's access.
Colorado is on odd years, and so this year is going to be in Colorado. Can you give us a little more about the current location, what goes on there, where is it at, and of course, how can people get engaged? Like, I guess how they register and say they're coming.
Right. So registration is open at LandRoverNationalRally.org. And if you go there, you'll see you can register yourself, driver, type of vehicle, and any passengers you have. And the sooner you register, the better we can get a handle on how many attendees we have and make sure that we're good on the cocktail party and the banquet.
The important things.
Yeah, yeah.
All the important stuff.
Make sure you have enough whiskey to go around.
Right. And we're also recruiting trail leaders. If you're a qualified trail leader, especially if you have experience in Moab, we do comp you your registration. So that's about a $200 value. And we're always looking to expand the list of available trail leaders. And you only have to lead on two out of the three trail days to fit that commitment.
I'm experienced in blocking trails, but I guess that's probably not in demand.
Well, yeah, if you got a winch, you know, help you pull everybody out.
Are all trails led, or can people go on their own?
No, they do. In order to be covered by both our permit and our liability, you need to be on a lead trail. You could go on a trail by yourself, but you won't be covered under the auspices of Solihull Society, since we do have a permit with BLM that specifically says which trails we're permitted on, maximum number of vehicles per trail, which is typically a leader in front, a leader in back, and 10 vehicles in between.
How many trails are there typically?
We've got double check the number of trails that we're scheduled for. So we've got five of them in an area BFE. We have about seven easy trails. We've got another seven medium to low difficult trails. And then we have probably about 10 hard trails. And a couple of the trails have bypasses around all obstacles. A good example is Flatiron Mesa, which we haven't done in recent years, but we did run it during the trail leader training event just last month. And all of the difficult obstacles have bypasses around them, so we can actually take it through. I would still call it a medium trail with the bypasses, but those are some good examples. This year we've also added the opportunity to do an overnight camping, so some of the longer trails, typically you'd be returning at night, but this way they'll be able to camp out at the far end of the trail and then return. That'll be a Wednesday's trail, so that they're returning on Thursday morning, the non-trail day.
Now, is this a typical Western trail type opposed to the East, where there are no trees?
there are a few trees. There's a lot of scrub brush on some of the trails. Some of the trails go down near the Colorado River and the Dolores River, so there's certainly plenty of vegetation. But there's also Moab is famous for its slick rock, which right. Sounds like it's slippery, but it's actually some of the most traction friendly formations that are out there. So you're actually going up quite steep sandstone formations, and just excellent traction in most of those places. There are some creek beds that you go through that include some muddy areas, depending on what the weather is. But we'll be in the third week of September, so the temperatures will actually be pretty mild. I would expect probably around in the 80s during the hottest part of the day. So very tolerable compared to middle of summer, where you might hit 100 or 110.
Is that that's that humpback area?
Yes,
right? I've seen
so
pictures.
Right. So you're talking about Fins and Things, which has these enormous humpback formations, probably about two vehicles wide. So as you're going up, there's a pair of black tracks from the rubber of over many years. If you follow those tracks, you'll have a quarter to a half a vehicle on either side of the vehicle as you go up and over. It climbs up a couple of hundred feet, then tips over the other side and back down. Another one, Hell's Revenge, has a couple of classic fins to climb over.
Hold on, Jim. So the fins thing, so that's not as narrow as it looks when I see the pictures in the video?
it feels like you are one vehicle wide, but if you actually get out and stand on it, you see that the rounded crest that you're on is a little bit wider. There's probably room probably 2 feet either side of the rubber tracks that you can probably deviate and still be okay, but you certainly couldn't pass opposing traffic on the fins.
Gotcha.
I'm still processing your words when you say it climbs up and then tips over on the other side.
and again, if you're outside looking at it, you say, okay, it's a 30, 32 degree descent. But in your windscreen, the horizon disappears. And so you're looking at nothing but what feels like almost going straight down. But the traction is tremendous, and it's a very controlled ascent and descent.
I'd like to try the Land Rover's invisible bonnet right there. That would be
that's,
interesting.
Yeah, that's
to see.
The time to have that.
You're like, whoa! Yeah.
Cool. But there's plenty of small, medium, and large ledges to go over. Certainly, there's extra rocks to build up if you need to help somebody get over a ledge, and then we pull those back out of the way to leave the challenge for the next group. There's lots of side obstacles on many of the routes where you go over and work something called the escalator, which truly feels like a vertical ascent from probably 200-300 feet below the level.
Wow. In addition to trail riding, what else goes on? You have a banquet, you have time trials, or
it's not a competitive event that pretty much doubles the liability insurance on the permit. So there's no racing, there's no competitive anything that would drive a competition on the trail. So it's much more about the technical challenge of being able to get through the trail and drive off under your own power at the end, or do the trail fix that we need. We bring all kinds of additional equipment to protect the trail, such as little kits. And also in the Moab area, there's something called the cryptobiotic soil. So it's this sort of a crust on the top of the sand that helps for reduce erosion. And so you really have to stay on the trail itself to avoid disturbing these soils that take hundreds, if not thousands, of years to generate on the side. So there's also lots of geologists, anybody who's into flora and fauna. There's all kinds of stuff on the sides. Occasionally, we'll have somebody who's an expert in that area, and they'll actually go on a trail that's all about photography, or all about pictures of the plants, or the Anasazi, which are the ancient civilizations that populated these western areas. So there's lots of opportunities to do more than just go out on a trail. The scenery and just incredible formations, mm-hmm. and marveling at what's basically millions of years to carve these out.
Sure. How many people typically show up? We've had friends from the East Coast. Bill Fischel comes to mind, and Nick. He knows himself as Nick Danger, Nick Brinkle, friends of ours that have gone there. I'm just curious, how many people typically show up? Where do they come from? And mm-hmm. How's that work out?
We've had as many as 150, 175 vehicles, which equates to about 250 to 350 total participants. Mm-hmm. We've been significantly smaller over the last few years, more on the order of 60 to 80 vehicles and about 100 to 150 participants. And that's actually tends to be easier to manage in terms of making sure that everybody has an opportunity to go on the trails that they're most interested in. We've got folks that come down from Alberta, Vancouver, California. We've got a big contingent that comes up from Texas. We've got some from the upper Midwest, Wisconsin area. We've had quite a few from the East Coast. A couple of guys trailered their vehicles from Virginia a couple of Moab rallies ago. So they're coming from all over. As I mentioned, there was one guy who shipped his vehicle from overseas to try to come. And so there's really an opportunity. And with the 2 days on both ends of the rally for travel, you don't have to skip out on the banquet now, which quite a few people had to miss the Saturday trails and a Saturday banquet to be able to start heading home. But now with the Friday trails and the Friday banquet, that leaves Saturday and Sunday to get home.
So the National Rally is September 19th through the 23rd, 2016, in Colorado, some secret undisclosed location that only...
No, it's in Moab, Utah.
Oh, it's in Moab. Oh, that's right. Yeah,
this is an even year.
I was thinking about me trying to go next year, but I'm thinking I really want to go to Moab. So
Going next year, it'll be somewhere as yet to be determined in
a secret undisclosed location in Colorado.
Now, run us down on the costs of this event.
It's 200 for the driver, and then 150 bucks for passengers, and I think another discount or free for kids that are I want to say it's under 10 maybe. So
kids that are under driving age,
right? Under driving age, and that's because the cost to support the trails, the permits, the trail leaders, is generally shared by the drivers, and then the cost of those who eat a lot at the banquet and cocktail party would be the rest of the passengers, and then the little kids, they're pretty much leftovers as far as. Although we've in the last couple of years we've been trying to aim for to make it more family friendly. So last year we had it at the last week of July in Grand Junction, Colorado, and had passes to the swimming pool. And a year before that we had Uray, and we had the hot springs. The kids and families could go there. There's plenty of hiking opportunities. Arches National Park, you don't have to go wheeling every day of the rally if you want to go up to Arches and do some sightseeing up there. There's plenty of opportunities to do that, and most of your evenings are open other than the cocktail party and the banquet.
If anyone listening to the podcast does one thing, I think that should be on there, everybody's bucket list. You should go to Moab, see Arches National Park and the Navajo Nation. I think it's called the Navajo Nation National Park. It's just amazing. It's just go. Don't worry about being, whether it's a Land Rover or not, just or a Land Rover event. Just go. It's amazing out that way. I was there years ago before I got into Land Rovers, and I actually did a Jeep tour. They threw us in a Jeep and went bounding about all those areas where John Ford filmed all his films, and it was just amazing. Fabulous. Right. I can't say enough about that.
Yeah, that reminds me, the Land Rover National Rally isn't limited to Land Rovers. We've had Jeeps. We had a Unimog coming one year, nice. Which was quite exciting. So
Unimogs get a free pass no matter where they go.
One guy's Land Rover broke on the way to Uray, and so he actually did the rally with a rented Jeep.
Right on.
Good for him.
But if you if you were thinking of going to Moab and you were going to go during like say the Easter Jeep Safari with 1,500 vehicles, and it's just crazy busy. The Land Rover National Rally, which we intentionally deconflict from large events like that, is a great opportunity to visit and enjoy Moab and the area with fewer folks around.
So remind our listeners how they can get more information about the National Rally and register if they're interested in going.
So the Land Rover National Rally website for registration is landrovernationalrally.org, and solihullsociety.org is for the club itself. We do have a discount that's applied for Solihull members, and if you're out of state, the membership is far less, again, because some of the other things that Solihull Society does for its members are Colorado related. And if you don't live in Colorado, can't take advantage. So we give you a discount on membership there. Right. Many of our sponsors offer a discount to Solihull members. Great Basin Rovers in Salt Lake City and JJ's Toy Shop in Erie, Colorado have discounts. And most of the dealers and most of the private independent shops offer a discount as well.
Nice. Well, Jim, I want to thank you very much for telling us about the National Rally. Is there anything we didn't mention or talk about before we talk about you? Was there something?
I don't think so. We really encourage your listeners to think about coming to the rally, and you won't regret it. It's a wonderful, wonderful week of four-wheeling and camaraderie and visiting with other Rover folks.
Sure. I think you guys have a Facebook page too, don't you? There's a Land Rover National Rally Facebook page?
Yes. I think if you look up Solihull Society, it probably has the shortest link to to the rally and to Solihull Society and our other the various events that we do.
Right, and that's actually a good place to go if you want to see pictures and know what's going on or when the event happens and those things. Of course, I'll have a link in the show notes to the website that you mentioned, but the Facebook is good just to keep it in your face and remind you of it. It's pretty. There's usually some nice pictures out there too of the sites. So,
absolutely.
All right, Jim, we're going to turn to you How long have you been a Land Rover guy, and how? What was your first Land Rover? You said was a Freelander. How'd that?
It was a Freelander. It was because we had to have something for four wheel driving in Colorado Springs in the snow, and the kids enjoyed the Land Rover. We looked at a couple of other cute utes, settled on a Freelander, and promptly went four wheel in early April, which was too early that year in 2003. Top centered on some snow up toward Pikes Peak, and had to dig ourselves out. So after that, we started going on Land Rover dealer sponsored tours, and then I discovered the Solihull Society, and there's a whole bunch of guys, and they know how to fix stuff on the trail. So.
Yes,
but the Freelander doesn't have too much clearance, and so we didn't have it modified. It was stock with maybe 6 or 8 inches of clearance. Mm-hmm. So we shifted. We added a 2001 Discovery SE7, nice. And then we traded that one in for a 2004 Discovery G4. And then we got another Discovery G4. So we actually have two orange pumpkins parked out on the driveway.
Right on.
Which makes it easy for people to find us.
You're definitely headed in the right direction in your choice of vehicles.
You haven't gotten the bug for anything older, any heritage vehicles?
Through the Solihull Society, I've met so many of the folks that drive, classics. Bill Burke's Four Wheeling America. He's got a wonderfully capable Range Rover Classic that he conducts trail leader training in, as well as a Defender. So, I like the comfort and the fact that the two Rovers they have now are my commuters. So they do have to pull me into the driveway at the end of the day under my own power.
What was the year of the Freelander that you had?
It was a 2002 model year. We bought it in February of 2003.
Okay.
We really enjoyed it. In fact, that's pretty much got us to bite the bigger Land Rover bug over the years.
Had you been into off-roading or trucks before that, or was that your first?
Not at all. I'm a Navy guy, so I've been in flying. I was flying stunt kites for a while and playing racquetball. So I've done some hiking and a little bit of mountain biking, but nothing really. It was once we got into Land Rovers that we started going off-roading and discovering how much more of the outside world is accessible through through four-wheel drive vehicles and capability. So half of what we do is for the sightseeing that you can't see from the road, and the other half is for the technical challenge of working through trails and improving off-roading skill. And off-roading skill really helps your on-road skills, understanding how the different parts of the vehicle work and what's happening through all the systems of the vehicle that also helps you to understand what's happening out on the road.
I can answer your question, John, a lot simpler. The fact that the Freelander was his first Land Rover tells me he had no prior four-wheel drive experience. Freelanders are people who've never been off-road before, have never had a four-wheel drive, and it's a great purpose for that, but
it's also it was also cheap relative to other maintenance wasn't.
I've yet to find anybody with prior four wheel drive experience who starts with a Freelander.
Yeah, it's probably true.
That's true. And
neither good nor bad. It just is
a very very small percentage of Land Rover owners who actually do go four wheel. And so part of what the Solihull Society is to encourage Land Rover owners to take full advantage of the capabilities of their vehicle and go off-road and discover how much more the vehicle is capable of doing.
And all I can think of is a story that we talked about earlier in the news segment when Land Rover is working on autonomous off-road vehicles. Yeah.
Yeehaw.
Exactly. Yes. I suspect that, it just, that doesn't.
Well, the one feature of that I like is the ability to get out and self-spot. You could get out and see the obstacle and then guide your vehicle over it using a remote control. I think that's pretty cool.
That would be, yeah. Of course, the things they're thinking about have sensors that will detect the vehicle, where it's going, whether it changes. And
yeah, you know, if you want that experience, why don't you just stay home?
That's that's pretty much
it. In your lazy boy chair.
Yeah. The only thing I think it'll be good for, as that article indicated, was that it'll be good for on-road, but in bad weather, like snow and ice and things like that. So that's the only positive I can see from all that. But we talked about that already. We shouldn't rehash that story. Jim.
I can rehash that all freaking day.
As we usually do.
My opinions are no secret.
We love talking. We love talking. Well, Jim, thanks very much. Is there a new truck in the offing, or are you pretty satisfied at the moment?
You know, every time I pull one of my vehicles into the service bay for repairs, there's a little sign there that says, "Hey, do you own a 2004 Discovery 2? We want to buy that." I keep telling them, you know, it's gonna rust in my driveway from all the use, and even tell my wife that her car is gonna be my parts bin, and she comes back with, "Whose car is gonna be whose parts bin?" Since I break mine a lot more frequently than she does.
Does she go with you? Does she have her own Disco then?
She does. She has her own 2004 Discovery G4. And one time we were on what's called Metbury Gulch, and I broke my front differential, and she drove through and wasn't shy about pointing out that that mine dragged itself off using the center diff and coming out on the back wheels, and she was just fine coming back out.
Good for her. Good for her. Well, that's good that you guys have your own vehicles and go out and off-road. I think that's fantastic. Yeah. Well, Jim, I want to thank you very much for joining us on the show today and talking about the National Rally and your own interest in Land Rovers. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you, John. We'll put in a good plug for Center Steer and
please do.
Make sure that we run some traffic to you, and hope to talk to you again soon and give you an update on what we're doing and how the rally is coming along.
Absolutely. Please do. You're welcome back anytime. Talk about the National Rally or anything else. And I already did see an increase in our Facebook likes anyways from Sully Hall Society folks. So there's been two or three. I think you were one of them. So thank you.
There you go.
Yeah, woo-hoo. Maybe our numbers increase. That's wonderful. Good. Hey, thanks again, Jim. Have a good day.
Thank you too. Bye bye now.
Welcome back to the Center Steer Podcast, show number 40. We have a second guest this month. I'm very excited to introduce to you Eric Yohe with Muddy Chef, and welcome Eric to the show.
Hi guys. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. And you got to tell people where you are and where the cell phone is, because I find that I find that fun.
I'm in an 04 Discovery 2 with the air conditioning on, because it's 100 degrees out of here, so in the northwestern corner of Connecticut, and the phone is jammed into the sunroof of the Discovery so I can get a signal.
Wonderful. Hopefully it doesn't overheat. So we'll try to get right into it then. So Muddy Chef, what is Muddy Chef, and for our listeners who are not familiar with it, and how did it come about?
Well, the official name is the Land Rover Muddy Chef Challenge. It was created in 2008 in Stowe, Vermont, and we like to call it essentially Top Chef meets Top Gear. It's the same sort of crazy, wacky, fun experience. It's a weekend that combines overlanding, off-road driving, sporting field events of navigation, land navigation, compass navigation, and two vehicle-based gourmet cooking challenges. And that sort of is the essence. There's lots of other activities, but sort of the cliff notes of what the Muddy Chef is.
That's, I have to say, pause you right there. That's cool. That just sounds just cool. I want to be there now.
Yeah.
Well, you know, do you know Nick Brinkle, Nick Danger?
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a friend of ours, and he's I've off-roaded with him in the past. I know he's participated in Muddy Chef. I just had to make that connection.
Is anybody that's on the call right now going to come to the Muddy Chef?
Morgan might.
No, I'm not going to make it down, unfortunately.
Yeah, Morgan doesn't have a functioning rover at the moment.
That shouldn't stop you.
That's true.
I wasn't planning on it, but I was asked so many times this weekend while in New York that I was actually starting to at least kick it around. The guys from Lucky 8 I know are coming up, Eric, and I was out with, you know, Justin and Eric and Kevin Barnes and some of those folks.
When is the Money Chef Challenge exactly, since you're asking if we're coming?
When is it? It's July 28th to the 31st in Lakeville, Vermont, Lakeville, Connecticut, and specifically it's held at the Lime Rock Park racetrack.
That's very cool. Unfortunately, I'm already on vacation, so unfortunately that's not a good time for me. But
I've been wanting to come for years, but I just haven't been able to put it together and make the time.
So how did it come about? Like, where did it start? Did it start off as a Land Rover event, or did it start off as a kind of a food event?
Well, we've always been, you know, I'm an ex-Land Rover and Michelin driving instructor, and most of my friends are former or current Land Rover driving instructors. And I owned a hotel in Stowe, you know, 8, and we were just trying to figure out what's a cool thing we can do for a weekend to get people involved with it. And somebody said, hey, let's do some cooking out of the back of the truck. And I said, all right, I'll do the off-road. And I think the first one, we had 20 to 30 people out there cooking. And we realized it was, and they were having a really good time. So we thought this was a really interesting thing, and they wanted to see kind of where it went.
So what kind of cooking skills do you need?
Well, I mean, I think there's the people think that I can cook, I can't cook. The people that come, you need, the short answer is you need to be a really good chef to have even the remotest shot of winning. The people that attend are mentally insane. They are the highest level of cooking you can possibly imagine, being that it comes out of the back of a Land Rover. You're talking professional chefs, like gourmet five-star chefs, get stomped by amateurs every single year. They get absolutely annihilated.
Wow.
So we said everybody has to cook. You don't have to cook well. You just have to try.
So I guess style plays into it then.
Yeah, I mean, one year somebody came up with a bunch of hot dogs and they took the hood of the disco off and served it on that.
There you go. Which actually leads me to the question, where exactly is the cooking taking place? Because, you know, some listeners might think that you're actually cooking on the engine. I'm guessing that's not the case.
No. The basically, it's everything you can carry in the Rover, you can cook out of. So we had a guy last year with a D90 with a Viking grill mounted to a trailer hitch on the back of it. So you can cook with gas. You can cook with your engine if you want. You can cook with firewood. You can cook with anything you want. It's just you have to carry them in your Land Rover. You can pull a trailer and that can have stuff in it, but it has to come in a Land Rover.
Nice. And then the event, though, takes place all over a portion of Vermont, correct? It's not just in one location. You actually are traveling.
Well, I'm sorry, Connecticut.
Connecticut, my apologies.
In Connecticut, yeah. So, yeah, there's a couple different events. So Thursday, which is the 28th of July, there's some training sessions. We've got some real interesting people coming this year. There is Will Hedrick. I'm letting you guys know who that is.
We do.
Yeah, we might know who he is.
Yes, yes.
So Will Hedrick's going to be, he's coming, he's attending, he's going to speak. We've got Arconic flying in from the UK with Arconic. They're bringing Arconic trucks to the event. We've got Sam Watson from Land Rover Owner. He's going to be there. So there's a lot of things going on. And the Thursday is training, and then Saturday is shotguns at Orvis and off-road driving at Orvis. And then back to the long answer, I'm sorry for this question, is on Friday night, we have essentially what's like the TV show Chopped. Have you guys ever seen Chopped?
Yes.
So what happens is the people that participate in that load up their trucks. They drive to a location. This year it's a distillery, and line up, and we present them with a basket of mystery food. They don't bring any food at all, and they're challenged to cook stuff they've never seen before and make some sort of a gourmet meal out of it in an hour. And that's limited to 15 teams, and the competition in that is pretty cool.
And then that's Friday. So then what, Saturday?
Saturday is we go to a Crown Maple Estate, and a 6-mile private off-road course at a big farm, and drive all day there. And then the main event, the Buddy Chef Challenge, happens on Saturday night, and that's like 100 teams cooking 3 courses.
Wow. sounds like a killer event. Gee, I kind of wish my didn't already have vacation plans. That would be, of course, not that I'm not a cook.
The other thing that hasn't been said, which is why the Love Muddy Chef is legendary, is that we go out and we find the best craft spirit and beer providers, and it's free the entire weekend. So we'll go out, register, we've got Tito's Vodka. We've got Hill Rock Estate Distillery, which does a world-class bourbon. We've got Thomas Two Rum out of Newport, Rhode Island. We've got Stony Creek Brewery out of Brantford, which makes a whole bunch of really amazing craft beers. And Harpoon Brewery as well, all served by the 13th Street Cocktail Catering. And is the social aspects of the evening, you can imagine, are pretty fun because you get free stuff the whole weekend.
That's the best part of any Land Rover event is the evening activities.
Yeah. But very few have catered complimentary free spirits and beer the whole weekend. So,
absolutely. And I've been to Harpoon Brewing. That is that's a really good brewery. I enjoy their product. How much is it, by the way?
How much is it? It's a bit of a moving target. It was originally $125. Early registration, it was $125 for the event, $125 for the camping. That gets paid directly to Lime Rock to cover security 24-hour. We have EMTs and security and all that stuff. So it was like $250, something like that. And now it's late registration, so it's $300 for the whole weekend.
Yeah, still, for what you get, that's not that bad.
Yeah, so really what you're doing is you're paying Lime Rock half of that just for the track rentals, and the other half comes to us.
Right.
And the welcome bag that everyone gets is ridiculous. The stuff that's in there, it's not junk. It's unbelievably neat stuff.
I assume it's Land Rover and off-road related?
Half a bottle of Thomas II Rum to start. Hill Rock Estate bourbon is in there. T-shirts. There is Crown Maple Syrup, which is a really expensive world-class syrup. There are camping stuff like LED headlamps. There's a lot of really neat stuff in the bag.
Now, does that include access to the track?
Well, this year, it's kind of neat. On Thursday, we're going to do hot laps. So Lime Rock's going to provide we've got a Jag from our sponsor, Prestige, I think an F-Type R. If you're in front of a computer right now, look up Jag F-Type R, and you'll see that's a pretty special car.
Don't have to look it up.
And, yeah, we know.
Pro drivers will be there, and you'll get hot laps on the track. And then on the Sunday, as the event concludes, we take all the trucks out and do a parade laps around Lime Rock.
Cool.
That's really, nice. Really cool.
And Ferrari is on the track that weekend as well. So there's a long tradition of people that are running the track will roll up and find Muddy Chef people and say, you want to go for a ride? And they'll jump in and they'll take them out on the track for high-speed rides.
Right on.
So nice. let me summarize it. So gourmet food, free booze, Ferraris, off-roading, sporting clay shooting, and a beautiful private location.
Now, do you have to enter the cooking competition to show up, or can you show up and take part in the other
stuff? No, it's the Muddy Chef Challenge. So it's you got to cook.
All right.
You don't have to cook well. You got to try. It's fair. People have spent the better part of a year, practicing, testing, and all that stuff. We want everybody to participate.
All right.
The amount of input you put into it's up to you.
All right. So you have to show up, and you have to do something with food.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many people do you usually get attending?
I think that this year we're looking at over 100 plus Land Rover trucks.
Nice.
So between, and then support vehicles, and then what, 3 to 5 people in a truck and a team, so probably 1,000 people.
That's a large event. That's significant.
That's formidable.
Yeah, that is.
It's growing. You know, I think that it's evidenced by the sponsors that we've got. And in particular, the people that keep coming back year after year, they make it worth the effort. I mean, this is a completely volunteer, zero profit event. And the people that do it just do it because they like it and love to see people having a good time. And And it's really rewarding to see this thing grow.
It's really cool. So where do people get more information, or if they're looking to sign up, I guess you can still sign up. I assume it's MuddyChef.com?
Yeah, www.MuddyChef.com. And for more information sort of on the day-to-day, what's going on, you definitely want to visit the Muddy Chef Facebook page.
And I assume that's Muddy Chef will get you to the Facebook page?
Yeah.
Yep. Good. I'll have links in the show notes, but it's always good to verbally confirm all that info.
Well, one last thing, if I may, is there is not only is there sort of middle of the road off road experience to be offered, there's also super hardcore stuff on Friday and Saturday. So if you've got a built rig, or if you've got a brand new Range Rover Autobiography, we've got something for both of those sorts of people.
That's important. That's cool. Nice. Well, let's talk about you, Eric. How did you get into Land Rovers, and how did that happen? You obviously drive a D2. Do you have anything else?
So how I got involved was after September 11th, I was working in New York City, and I decided that really didn't work for me. So most of my life, I've been a ski instructor, and I had a relationship with Southern Vermont for a long time. So I basically pulled up stakes and moved to Vermont. And I think the first thing you do when you get to Vermont is they give you a Labrador Retriever, a shotgun, and a Land Rover when you go across the border.
That sounds exactly like Morgan, yeah.
I believe that is requirements of citizenship.
Started driving a Range Rover Classic and was living near Manchester. And as you know, the Land Rover driving school is there. And at the time, it was called Country Pursuits because Land Rover had pulled out of off-road schools at that point. So we had Discoveries and we had Hummer H2s, which is a miserable car, just for the record.
Yeah.
You don't even need to say that.
Every time we drove one of those, we got the Vermont salute, which you can probably imagine. If you see somebody in Vermont driving a white Hummer, you can imagine what the salute was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a Chevy Tahoe,
so
let's face it.
I ended up running the school for a couple of years, and then Land Rover came back. And, you know, Gene Schubert is a very well-known off-road guy. He's been a friend of mine for 20 years. He's an off-road driver there. So a lot of us have a long history together sort of teaching and driving in off-road.
Cool. And I guess you left that moved to Connecticut, and then that's the Muddy Chef Challenge kind of came about.
Yeah, well, yes, that's the story I'm sure people care about. There's a longer story, but
sure.
I've owned every model Land Rover there is, and some of them, quite frankly, are a pain in the butt, right? But I have a 61 Series 2A that's unrestored, and that car is as honest gets. It is a cool car to drive.
Yeah, nice. 61 Series 2.
I miss my Defender 110 the most, though.
Ah, what year's your Defender, your 110?
It was an 80 something, but it was so they're awesome after you replaced all the original parts.
Oh, yes.
Yes, once restored.
Yes, indeed. Indeed.
It might have been an 80 something, but it was brand new when I was done with it.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Good deal. And is that your daily driver, the 110?
We have an 04 D2 now that we drive a lot.
Okay.
If you look at the website, MuddyChef.com, it really captures it. The front page will really sort of explain what it is and what it's about and all that stuff. And I encourage people to, with any level of cooking ability, to give it a shot. Because it's more than just cooking. It's the camaraderie and the friendship and the fun that you'll get during the weekend. It's very unlike anything else.
Right. Definitely sounds like it. It's a singularly unique event. So that's...
Yeah, I've really been wanting to go myself for a few years, but I keep telling myself, get the meat wagon done, then I can show up and make meat with the meat wagon.
There you go. Harold has a Series 3 ambulance.
Nice.
And hence the name.
I think the best thing I could say to you is ask anybody who's been.
Right. Yeah, I know Morgan has, since he's kind of local to you, has been talking about the event. And of course, Nick has been to the event, and he's said good things about it. And was really, what did he take though? Did he take a Series?
I think he took his Series truck.
He did. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he did.
Yeah.
That was one of those moments when it was running.
Yeah, that was like 2 years ago, I think.
Yeah, I think was he and his brother made chili or something?
That sounds like Nick.
They didn't make chili. They made a meatloaf in a Dutch oven. It was amazing.
Oh, yeah, I know. It was Dutch oven involved. That's sort of his thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I like how Eric remembers what people made.
Yeah, that's pretty good. You know, 1,000 people remembers what they all made.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Eric, hey, you're out in the trail, sitting in the hot weather, and with the AC on, which is a good thing. But I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking to us about the Money Chef Challenge. I think that's a really cool event.
Well, thank you guys. I appreciate it. Again, I apologize for missing you when we first called, and maybe we'll do a follow up. We'll tell you how the event went at a later date.
That'd be great. Absolutely,
would be awesome.
Thanks for joining us on the show, Eric, and have a good Money Chef Challenge. And hope to have you back on the show when that event is over. Maybe let us know how things went and prepare us for next year.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys.
Welcome back to the Zenosteer Podcast, show number 40. Our regular contributor, Dave, was at an off-road event this weekend, and he's now traveling back home, and we were able to get him to join us via Skype to give us a field report. So, Dave, you're stuck in traffic. So where were you, and what happened?
I was in Glenwood, New York, at an event. It's a relatively new event. It's only the second year that they've offered it. It is called Rovers on the Slopes, and it is a very small event by design, but one that, if you make the list for people to go, I think a lot of people would really enjoy.
So who put it on? Where exactly in New York? So Western New York, I assume?
Yeah, so Glenwood, New York is about 235 miles from Pittsburgh. I know that doesn't tell most of you listeners out there a whole lot. It's south of Buffalo.
That's not far for us.
Yeah, so it's not terribly far. It's a pretty convenient location. There's a lot of access from, you know, highways to relatively close points around the location for the event. It's actually held at a ski resort called Kissing Bridge Ski Resort. They're in Glenwood, New York, and it's a pretty great event. It's put on by Lucky 8 LLC. You know, as most listeners probably know, at least if they're driving anything other than a series truck, then most people probably know that, you know, Lucky 8's an off-road parts supplier. They also do supply all of the usual maintenance and repair parts. I don't think people necessarily are quite as aware of that, but that is something that they offer. They put this event on. The venue was spectacular. It's not a huge ski resort, but it includes a lot of trails for all types of vehicles and skill levels.
Was this Land Rover only?
This was a Land Rover only event, yeah.
And how many trucks and what variety?
We only had about 14 or 15 trucks. And by design, they're going to limit this event every year to a very limited number. Last year, they had 20 for their inaugural event. But this year, they opened it up, and they were going to offer it out to a total of 40 people. I don't think they ever got quite that many.
Now, is this invitation only? Is this invitation only, or is it first come, first serve on that 40 truck?
It's not invitation only, but they advertised it a little more selectively, so to speak.
So it is first come, first serve. You have to know about it, right? Is there camping on site, or are you staying in a hotel?
There is camping on site. It's right at the resort. They set us up actually right at the base of, right where their lodge was, right at the base of all of their ski runs, or a lot of their ski runs. So that we were able to have access to just about everything. The resort is largely closed at this time of year.
Right.
So
what kind of amenities? What kind of terrain are we talking? Rocky, hilly, typical eastern
hilly.
U.S.
Well, it was hilly. It was muddy. There were rocks, but I mean, it's not something that I would call terribly rocky.
Pinstriping.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at having some pinstriping coming out of it. Generally speaking, there were a lot of vehicles that were only lightly modified. We had an LR4, several LR3s, at least a couple of the LR3s were on street tires and with no measurable width. So, I mean, there were actually a number of completely stock series trucks.
Nice. What did you take?
I took my D2, falls into the heavily modified category. There were really only three trucks there that I thought were heavily modified.
Okay.
One was the Lucky 8 LR3. Their latest modification was to try and fit 35-inch tires under it. Sadly, it didn't survive our run Saturday morning. It was something that they kind of expected, because nobody makes any kind of a heavy-duty axle for it yet, or CV. So we got into a ravine that wasn't part of one of the trails until we'd actually gone through it. And Justin suffered a broken CV joint. Mm. But it was all part of, you know, he knew that he was going to probably break a CV.
Right.
At some point this weekend, he needed to understand how far he could push the truck with the bigger tires on it, so that now he knows, or has a feel for at least, how he needs to go about beefing up and strengthening the weak point. So,
were these all lead trails, or could you go off on your own? Well, I guess you only had a small number of trucks anyways.
Well, they did have people. They did have guys on quads that led all of us. The Kissing Bridge people were really great. They were phenomenal hosts. They needed to have somebody lead us, but that's primarily because they didn't have any good way of mapping the trail system. This isn't something that they've typically done on a regular basis, and they weren't sure what the mix of vehicles would be.
No, right.
So it was good. They're very rover friendly. The guy that runs the resort is also a fellow rover owner.
That helps.
And he came out in a pair of his Range Rovers at different points.
So what else happened besides trail riding? Did you was there, you know, a banquet or, you know, any technical aspects? You know, was there any competitions?
There really weren't any competitions. There was a dinner on Saturday night that was catered by the resort.
Ooh, nice.
They actually opened up their patio area and gave us access to their commercial grill and their fire pits, so nobody needed to worry about bringing any kind of wood or anything like that.
That's really nice.
Yeah.
So, normally everything at the resort is closed. They opened up the bar and everything so that, you know, anybody that wanted to partake and who didn't bring their own, mm-hmm. Was able to partake.
How much did the event cost?
It was $125 for the truck and driver, and then $25 for every attendee over the age of 12 after that.
Okay. Good. So what was your favorite part? Well, I assume was the off-roading. Was that the best part?
Yeah. They had trails that, you know, we ran with some guys in some stock series trucks and some X-Mod D90s that were completely stock. And then those of us in the more heavily modified vehicles split off, and while they didn't necessarily have trails set up for us, they were incredibly accommodating, and they set trails up for us. They went and actually created some trails within their trail system for those of us in the more heavily modified vehicle. So, I mean, I can't say enough about the hospitality of the folks at Kissing Bridge. It was pretty phenomenal.
They're going to do it again next year, same time?
My understanding is that is the plan.
Good. Good. Well, we look forward to letting us know when that happens. Maybe we can let our listeners in on the invitation part of it, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
There was one interesting development that I should probably share with you guys. As some of you know, and as I'm sure some of our listeners know, Trailhead 4x4, which is a shop just south of Cleveland, and its proprietor, Eric Brown, have fit a third-generation Chevy LS V8, so 4.8-liter V8, into a D2. And they have it working with the stock Discovery 2 wiring harness and the stock Bosch engine management system.
Interesting.
So that's big news.
Yeah.
Eric's going to be putting together a package that could allow the D2 to see some real long-term longevity.
Right.
Beyond the life of the Rover V8.
Now, does that require reprogramming the ECU?
No.
Huh. Okay.
But the whole point, the reason I bring this up is because Eric drove the truck up. He's done two trucks now. He put it in one just to see if it would work. He pulled it out. He put it into a good D2 that he has that he runs around in whenever he's prototyping things. And drove it up to Kissing Bridge from Cleveland, two or three hour drive.
Yeah.
Brought it in, took a bunch of us for a spin in it, and it's impressive. It is really
nice,
really interesting. We may want to see if we can talk to him about it at some point.
Absolutely.
Because I didn't capture any pictures. I wish I had. It's a very clean install, and I mean, anybody driving a D2 that's ever had an engine problem should really be following this.
Well, not only that, but I'm thinking in terms of torque output and mileage and things like that. It's an improvement.
Yep. Yeah, it is.
Well,
I think he said he was getting somewhere around 14 right now, but that was using an airbox. It was a Mitsubishi airbox that he did not have hooked up to his ARB snorkel. So,
cool.
Yeah, you know, he's sucking hot air from within the engine. So there's still a little work to do. But everything that really has to function is functioning as it should.
Cool.
So,
Send us over the info, Dave, and we'll see if we can get him on the show to talk about that conversion. That sounds like it'd be really interesting.
Or bring it down to the studio.
Yep. Even better. Well, thanks, Dave, for giving us the field report. Really interesting. And I'm glad you were able to do it and not have any major issues. So, all right.
In the interim, I'm going to be at Southington Off-Road on August 7th. So
oh, there you go.
If anybody wants to come on out and meet.
Yep.
I'm still towing around the prize that you tried to get me to give away at Winter Rock, John.
All right.
It's in the back seat of my disco. So if somebody shows up, It's still there waiting to be claimed.
There we go. For listener, track down Dave Carroll in a Blue Disco 2, and Dave will have a special for the first listener that says they listen to the Center Steer podcast. He'll have a special prize for them.
Great. Thanks.
And now on the Center Steer podcast, it's time for the Heritage segment. We've moved into Range Rovers, and this month, our Heritage coordinator, correspondent, contributor, Morgan, is going to handle wheels and axles. Take it away, Morgan.
Thank you very much. I had initially introduced you to the Range Rover, which is now referred to as the Range Rover Classic, which was Rover Company's 1970 successor to the Land Rover and their entry into the SUV market. It quickly proved its off-road capabilities, partially due to the chassis and suspension that we discussed last month. As we continue the technical dive into the Range Rover Classic, let's look at where the rubber meets the road, or dirt, with tires, brakes, and axles. A lot of engineering went into the Range Rover, and the Rover company partnered with several companies to develop parts, including their tires. Land Rover has always favored tall, narrow tires as they can sink down through upper layers of mud and snow to make contact with firm ground below and still be aired down for better stay on top of sand. Michelin developed a custom tire, the XMS 244, which was a 205 R16, more precisely 205 80 R16. With these properties for standard fitment to the Range Rover, these mud and snow tires performed very well in on- and off-road situations and could be studded as well. These were used from introduction until 1995, when they were replaced by a new Michelin 4x4 XPC tire in the same size, the custom 205 80 R16. Unfortunately, those tires being long discontinued at this time, and being a unique size, it's hard to find them here in the U.S. That said, there are still many options available in this size in the U.K., including popular models such as the Cooper Discoverer STs, Goodyear Wranglers, General Grabber TRs, and others. For those of us in the U.S. who might not want to import tires from overseas, there are some similar sizes that can be fitted. The most commonly suggested is 225-75 R16, which has a slightly larger diameter and has only a little wider section width, so generally doesn't have any issues with rubbing. There are many popular tires in this size, including the BF Goodrich All-Terrain TA-KO2s and their Mud-Terrain MT-KM2s, the General Grabber AT2s, the Goodyear Wranglers, etc. Alternatively, a 235-70 R16 is the same diameter as the original tires, but is slightly wider. While there are fewer options in this size, there are still some popular tires, such as the BF Goodrich All-Terrain TA KOs and the KO2s, the General Grabber AT2s, Goodyear Wranglers, etc. Note the lack of the BF Goodrich Mud-Terrain MT-KM2s in this size, so there are some tires you can't get. Naturally, when it comes to tires, people have tried all sorts of combinations on the Range Rover Classic, depending on their environment, intended use, and personal preferences, to different effect. Slightly wider tires, such as 255-65 R16, usually lose about 10 to 15% from steering lock due to rubbing, but don't necessarily require any modifications. Larger diameter tires to increase diff clearance and approach and departure angles are likely to rub and usually require lifts or body trimming, especially beyond 31 inches, as the standard tires are around 29 inches. Naturally, this also affects the vehicle speed due to the larger circumference of the tire traveling further on a single rotation than the standard tire size. So another thing to be aware of.
Also affects your acceleration, too.
Right, exactly.
It effectively changes your gearing. Now, on the other hand, if you do want to run that larger diameter tire, another way to cut down the rubbing is to use a wheel spacer.
Very true. Most notable in the 30 to 31 inch tire sizes is the 215 85 R16, as it's a similar width to the original standard tire size and almost the same dimensions as the 7.0 R16 tire size that was used on the Camel Trophy vehicles for a number of years. This size doesn't rub or require any modifications, but there have been reports of it causing oversteer, especially if you have worn suspension bushings, which obviously at this point is very common. Pretty much anything larger than that, and as you said, you're going to have to get into lifts or spacers or body trimming and probably, you know, all sorts of other driveline changes as you make those changes. While the tires keep your vehicle planted on the road and hopefully moving forward, let's not forget stopping. As any serious Land Rover owner knows, Rover had plenty of room for improvement in this area. Instead of drum brakes, they opted for four-wheel disc brakes, which provides much greater stopping power, are self-adjusting, and maintain stopping power after water crossings. This new braking system was servo-assisted with a dual-valve master cylinder and dual redundant brake lines for safety. Really, the only part of the braking system that remained similar to the series Land Rover was that of the parking brake, which was still a drum brake on the rear drive line behind the transfer case. Land Rover approved Schuler Presses, whose Range Rover division was later renamed to Overfinch, who we actually discussed earlier, to produce official conversions, which were even sold through Land Rover dealers. And in 1980, Schumer introduced the Super Ranger, which, in addition to custom gearbox and transfer case upgrades, included anti-lock brakes for increased safety. Despite this official approval of this model, ABS brakes didn't actually come to the Range Rover until 1990 with the Vogue edition. However, they did expand ABS to the full lineup later in that year. In 1990, they also upgraded the front disc brakes to ventilated rotors to better dissipate heat. And in 1992, the Range Rover actually took advantage of the ABS system to add electronic traction control, or ETC, which would automatically engage the brakes on a spinning rear wheel, diverting more power to the other wheel. And in terms of axles, Range Rover retained the rugged front and rear beam axle design, like that of the series Land Rover, with 10 spline axle shafts. These were upgraded to 24 spline around 1993. There are hardened 24 spline axle shafts in ABS and non-ABS versions that are available from a number of aftermarket vendors, including GBR in the US and Ashcroft Transmissions in the UK. Naturally, there are a number of differential upgrade options available as well, from different ratio changes to lockers of various types, including the usual Detroits, TrueTrax, Ashcroft, Limited Slip, ARB Air lockers, and what have you. Upon upgrading diffs, one will usually find that the CV joints are then the weak point. Fortunately, there are upgraded versions of those available as well. As you can probably tell at this point, on-road, off-road, and safety were considered very highly throughout the design of the Range Rover, with tires and especially brakes getting some serious focus. They didn't skimp on retaining the tried-and-true axle setup that had taken series Land Rovers to far corners of the globe and back again. Which is very nice of them. In the next Heritage segment, we'll probably move further up the drivetrain of the Range Rover Classic, probably to, you know, gearbox and transfer case.
I mean, we could talk for hours about various combinations and aftermarkets and this is and that's is, but it's a nice overview.
Yeah, and that's what I was going for, was an overview of that. We dug into a fair amount of that stuff in series. Obviously, it's different with Range Rover Classics, but anytime you get into those serious upgrades, you're starting to do a lot more math and engineering throughout your entire system, or at least you should be.
Yeah, because if you're not, you end up doing a lot of repairs.
Exactly. A lot of repairs or a lot of re-engineering and reconsidering and wasted money.
Yep.
Well, it depends on how much custom work you're doing. If you start at one end and start figuring out how you need to beat things up, quickly learn that as you create new weak points, you just have to be prepared to eliminate them before you get to the point of actually breaking things.
Absolutely.
Ask me how I know.
I think we do. I think we do.
I think you're pretty good at finding those weak points.
Dave is, yes. Indeed.
Well, I mean, the Ashcroft family had to put a bunch of kids through school, so I broke a bunch of shit and sent them a ton of money.
There we go. Thing I've noticed, at least for tires especially, like that's the first modification someone usually makes for their vehicle. They may not realize that, but if they're going off-roading, and that's probably the first thing that, you know, anybody will say to you is, well, what kind of tires do you have? Are they street tires or not? You know, like, oh no, I didn't do anything yet. Well, that should be your first real modification is in the tires. We talked about that before, not saying anything new, but that's, you know, it doesn't seem like, oh, they're just tires. No, not really. That's they're actually kind of very important to the whole off-roading capability. It's because that's what's touching the road after all, right? Or the ground.
Yeah, and you know, that's one of the things that's really interesting about the Range Rover Classic is that in their introduction, they really actually paid attention to that. So many vehicles these days, the stock tires are just crap tires that are not really worth driving on at all.
They are the lowest bidder.
Exactly. It's interesting that they were reasonable and well considered in the engineering originally, but they are absolutely the first thing to upgrade.
So thanks very much, Morgan, for covering wheels and axles for the Range Rover and Range Rover Classic. Next month is going to be gearboxes and transfer cases. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. We'll look forward to it next month. So this has been the 40th edition of the Center Steer Podcast. I want to thank everybody for joining us today. It was a whirlwind episode, getting everything together. And thanks to Harold sitting across from me for contributions today.
No problem.
And to from the Green Mountain State, and I always like to say that, Morgan, and thanks very much for contributing today.
Oh, you're entirely welcome.
And you run seriesparts.com. We should put that out there in the world so everybody remembers if they're looking for anything in the Series or Defender area and you want to figure out a shop or you're looking for a part, check seriesparts.com.
Thanks.
Quite welcome. Dave, thanks very much for contributing today and joining us from on the road. Appreciate your field report.
Great. Thank you for having me yet again. Hey, if anybody out there listening, Series 3 in a box, give me a call.
Dave is attempting to sell a truck on our show here.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, Dave has a Series 3 for sale. Yeah, absolutely. If you're interested in the Series 3, Dave is interested in one or interested in selling the one he has called Sherman. Yeah, absolutely. Just drop a message to the show and we'll put you in contact with Dave. And also thank you to our two guests today. We had Jim Janessa from the Sully Hall Society talking about the national rally, and hopefully we'll have him back and talk about the rally again. And also to Eric Yohe talking about the Land Rover Money Chef Challenge. I kind of wish I was at both events now. They both sound really interesting. So there you go.
Well, we've been talking about the Money Chef since we've started the show and just never been able to make it happen. It's nice to have somebody on from the event, and maybe one of these years we'll actually make it on site.
Indeed, indeed. And if any of our listeners are going and they want to report back after they attend the event, let us know. Get you on the show and we'll talk about it and make everybody else jealous. So that's the podcast for this month. I hope you enjoyed the show and thank you for listening. I want to remind you to visit our website for past shows and also the show notes and links with all the things we talked about today. Also visit 4x4radionetwork.com to listen to other shows that were part of the network. And you can connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, give us some feedback on the show, and give us some feedback on the news if you like. We have listeners from around the world, and I want to put a special welcome to all the Sully Hall Society folks that have joined in the last week that are listening. They run the National Rally in Western the United States. We have guests lined up for the next several months, including the Rebel Rally, the Sand Rally, Alloy and Grit, and we have a special guest in September. I don't know if I want to tell anybody, or should we give everybody a clue? I have a clue in mind. Dormobile. So if you know who that is, that's a special guest.
Very good clue. We'll
tune in next month for another clue.
Oh, yes. Next month, another clue. we'd love to hear from you, even if it's just a picture of your Land Rover or the Land Rover you lust after, or if you have a guest idea. So until next show, I ask you to share the show with one of your fellow Land Rover fans. Thanks for listening. Wave as you pass by.
mind for the rest of the show.
That's right.
And then fast forward for the end. It'd be fun to put together a show like that.